Good evening, everybody. This is Jim Breeling. Welcome tonight. We are really honored to have Leanna Clark as our presenter tonight. And she has a fascinating background. She pursued Japanese studies as a college student, then taught English in Japan for 4 years, then went to the University of Minnesota, where there was a big emphasis on psychometrics, still is, I guess, and did her dissertation on the translation of the MMPI into Japanese. She subsequently has gone on to have quite a career in psychology. She has published so extensively in journals that I got tired of trying to count them all. But more important than number, because a lot of times papers, as proud as the authors may be of them, are easily forgotten. But Leanna Clark is among the most cited psychologists. People have found her work of import and have cited it in their own work. She is also reviewed for numerous journals, but more than that, has been sought for leadership as a journal editor for 5 by my count. And in her academic career, she has also been sought for administrative role at the University of Iowa, where she was before coming to Notre Dame. Her talk, of course, here, by the way, she's also not just a member of various professional groups, but she is recognized for her achievements as a fellow in 5 of them, by my count. And she has served as president of the Society for Science of Clinical Psychology. It's a group of psychologists and departments that are really trying to make psychology a scientific discipline and every aspect, including treatment, using evidence-based treatments versus just nice ideas. And she has been sought after in other spheres, including she completed the service as a member of DSM-5 work group for personality disorders, and some of you already have some questions about that we were talking about before the show began. And in other things, she has received recognition for her excellence as a teacher from the University of Iowa in general faculty excellence, and in other areas is co-author of a report at the University of Iowa on sexual harassment survey report. And along the way, her kids got into soccer, and she became a certified soccer referee. So not only can she sit at a desk and write and go over research and teach classes and do sessions like this, she's presented so many times again, I gave up counting, but she's very mobile and able to keep up with the kids on the field of play. So with that, since she has a very full presentation, and as I say, we have lots of questions, and if you have them, be sure to shoot them in, as always, to the usual email address so we can organize and try to cover as many as possible. And so with that, let me stop and turn it over to Dr. Clark.
Thanks, Jim. That was a very kind introduction. I will assume that you have the presentation in front of you and try to remember every time to say when I'm moving to the next slide. So on the first one, simply the topic and introductory material. The second slide is required by APA that it's supposed to be included on every slide that has any exact content from the DSM-5, but I put it on this slide by itself so that you can actually read it, because when you put it on a slide with other material, you have to put it in like 10-point font, and it can't be read. So, and then the third slide is criterion A of the alternative model for personality disorder in DSM-5. Now, I assume that most or all of you know that the DSM-5 personality and personality disorder work groups alternative model was not accepted for inclusion in the main section of the text, which is Section 2, but it appears in Section 3, which is titled Emerging Models and Measures. And there are two major criteria for the DSM-5 Section 3 personality disorders, and the first one is on this slide. And I'm calling it, by the way, DSM-5.1. Some of you may have wondered why the Roman numerals were abandoned and the Arabic number substituted. And the idea was that rather than a major revision every 15 or 20 years, that they would try to move to a software model where the DSM was, of course, it would be printed, but it was also going to be online. And if there were some major breakthrough so that a particular disorder needed to be revised without having to revise the entire manual, just that portion of it could be changed and would be labeled 5.1, 5.2, and so forth. And only when a major revision was done would it then get updated to DSM-6. So I am hoping that the alternative model is the first major revision that occurs, and it will be the thing that catalyzes us moving to DSM 5.1. So the first criterion, criterion A, is moderate or greater impairment in at least two of the following four areas of personality functioning. This is actually a big conceptual shift from the DSM-4. DSM-4 disorders were defined in terms of traits, but the criteria themselves were actually a mixture of traits and other elements that have been pulled together here in the criterion A called personality functioning. Now, there are many more areas of personality functioning than this, but having more than about four would have just made the model too complicated. So we tried to focus on the four areas that were really the most central and came up with two that concerned the self, identity and self-direction, and two that concerned interpersonal relationships, empathy and intimacy. And each one of these can be scaled from 0 to 4, none to severe, and a moderate or higher severity is considered to be above the threshold for a personality disorder. And there are very fully elaborated definitions that I'll show you on a later slide. If you now move to the fourth slide, this gives you the definition of the self-domain of identity. Experiencing oneself as unique, having boundaries between oneself and the other, stability of self-esteem, accurate self-appraisal, capacity for and the ability to regulate emotional experience. Now, I'm going to focus primarily today on the trait component of the model, which I'll get to in a minute. But I'm going to illustrate for you how this first criterion A works, and I'm going to use borderline PD as the example. So first I'm going to walk you through just the definition, and then I'll show you how it plays out in borderline. So the next slide, slide number 5, is the self-domain of self-direction, pursuing coherent and meaningful goals, using constructive pro-social internal standards of behavior, and self-reflecting productively. The sixth slide gives the definition for the interpersonal domain of empathy, comprehending and appreciating others' experiences and motivations, tolerating different perspectives, and understanding the effect of your behavior on others. And then the seventh slide gives the definition for the fourth component, intimacy, the depth and duration of positive connection with others, desire, capacity for closeness, and a mutuality of regard reflected in interpersonal behavior. The eighth slide just shows you one example of the detailed definitions of these levels of functioning. This one is the second level. You can see the little two off to the right. And the four columns correspond to identity, self-direction, empathy, and intimacy. And these are the definitions for the moderate level above which you need to be in order to get a diagnosis or to meet this criteria for diagnosis for personality disorder. I'm not going to read through this. I'll leave it for you to look at later. And each one of the levels, 0, 1, 2, 3, and 4, are all spelled out in the Section 3 of the DSM-5. Now, the criterion B is shown on the next slide, 9. One or more pathological personality traits, and there are 25 specific facet traits that are listed in the Section 3 DSM-5, organized into 5 broad domains: negative affectivity, detachment, antagonism, disinhibition, and psychoticism. And definitions, again, of all of these traits, both the broad domains and the facets, are provided. And I'm going to come back to these because that's what I'm going to focus most of the talk on. But let me just give you the definitions quickly of each of those domains. Again, I'm going to sort of go through them quickly so that you'll have a broad understanding. I certainly don't have time to go through all 25 of the facets. The negative affectivity domain encompasses frequent and intense experiences of high levels of a wide range of negative emotions, and some of those emotions are listed, and also the behavioral consequences or manifestations of the emotions, both behavioral and interpersonal. And again, these are rated on a severity scale, with 0 and 1 being below threshold and 2 and 3 being at the level that would be required for making a diagnosis. One of the facets of negative affectivity is shown in slide 11. Emotional ability is a subcomponent, as it were, of negative affectivity and is defined by instability of emotional experiences and mood, emotions that are easily aroused, intense, out of proportion to events and circumstances. There are other criteria for a diagnosis of personality disorder beyond those two. What they do, and this is starting on slide 12, the other 5 criteria are qualifiers of the first two. They add parameters, such as the C criteria adds inflexibility and pervasiveness. The D criteria requires a certain degree of temporal stability, with the origins being traced back to adolescence or early adulthood, because we know that personality doesn't just appear in full form in adulthood. It develops over our childhoods and adolescence. And slide 13 shows the last 3 exclusion criteria. So if the impairment in personality functioning and trait expression is better explained by another mental disorder, for example, schizophrenia, then the personality disorder would not be diagnosed. F excludes if the impairments are attributable to physiological effects of a substance or some kind of severe head trauma. And the last one, to make clear that we are not talking about normal stages of development. You might look at the criteria and say, hey, that sounds like a 2-year-old. But obviously what's normative for a 2-year-old and what's normative for an adult are different, and so that has to be taken into account before one would make a diagnosis. On slide 14 are shown the 6 specific personality functioning and trait combinations that are provided in the alternative model. And I will give you an example, not of all of these. Again, it would take way longer than our hour, but I want you to get a feel for how the system works. So starting on slide 15, you'll see the full definition for borderline personality disorder. It starts with criterion A, with the 4 areas of personality functioning beginning with identity. So the idea is that in someone with the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder, the identity component of personality impairment takes the form of markedly impoverished, poorly developed, or unstable self-image that is associated with excessive self-criticism, chronic feelings of emptiness, dissociative states under stress. And I think this is a really good idea, good example of how the DSM criteria mixed together traits and functioning, because clearly you'll recognize this material as drawn from the criteria of DSM-4, but now separated out and recognized as examples of personality functional impairment, not as a trait manifestation. Slide 16 shows, happens to be a very brief definition for the way that self-direction would appear in the DSM alternative model, instability in goals, aspirations, vows, or career plans. Empathy, compromised ability, this is on to the next slide, sorry, compromised ability to recognize the feelings and needs of others associated with interpersonal hypersensitivity, prone to feel slighted or insulted, perceptions of others selectively biased toward negative attributes or vulnerabilities. And this is a good place for me to remind you that this is a generic definition, and the person would be rated on a scale, again, of 0 to 3, as to whether they exhibited this characteristic in an extreme form or maybe only a little bit, in which case they would get a 0 or a 1 and would not then meet the criteria for empathy. You have to have, you may remember, 2 out of the 4 to cross the threshold for the diagnosis. And then finally on slide 18, intimacy. Intense and unstable conflicted close relationships. Again, I think you will recognize some of the DSM-4 criteria brought into this personality impairment criterion in the DSM-5, marked by mistrust, neediness, anxious preoccupation, and so forth. Slide 19 then shows the personality traits that would be required for a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder in the alternative model. Would require 4 or more of the following 7, including at least one of the last 3. This is one of the most complicated of the 6 specific disorders that are in the alternative model. So it lists 4 aspects of negative affectivity. You may recall I showed you the definition of negative affectivity and of its facet, emotional ability, earlier. 3 other facets, anxiousness, separation insecurity, and depressivity. And then 2 aspects of the broad domain of disinhibition, impulsivity, and risk-taking. And 1 aspect of the broad domain of antagonism, which is hostility in this case. So in order to cross the threshold for a diagnosis of borderline PD, the individual would have to have a rating of 2 or 3, in other words, be above the threshold on at least 4 of these, and 1 of them must be either impulsivity, risk-taking, or hostility. The reason for that was to ensure that somebody did not get a diagnosis of borderline personality disorder on the basis of being high in negative affectivity alone. Slide 20 shows the definition of another one of the facets, anxiousness, feelings of nervousness, tension, or panic in reaction to diverse situations, frequent worry about the negative effects of past unpleasant experiences and future negative possibilities. The facets also have generic definitions, and in most cases, those generic definitions are applied to the specific personality disorders. But in a few cases, they are modified so that they fit better with the particular specific personality disorder. Slide 21 gives the definition of separation insecurity, fears of being alone due to rejection by and or separation from significant others. Slide 22 shows the definition of depressivity, feelings of being down, miserable, and or hopeless, difficulty recovering from such moods, pessimism about the future, pervasive shame or guilt. And you'll recognize a lot of negative affective, negative emotional words in this definition. And that's one of the reasons that this is one of the facets of negative affectivity. It's one of the components. It's also important to remember, though, that transient feelings of being down, transient feelings of hopelessness happen to everybody. So a person would not get rated at the threshold or above for this facet, this trait facet, unless this was a relatively stable and pervasive aspect of their personality, that they have these feelings intensely and frequently and pretty consistently over time and regardless of the situation. Again, not meaning that they would feel that way 100% of the time, but that this would be a characteristic expression for them. Slide 23 gives the definition of impulsivity: acting on the spur of the moment in response to immediate stimuli, acting on a momentary basis without a plan, difficulty establishing and following plans. And this is one example of where the definition has been modified slightly to fit with a particular type of personality disorder. In the last case, a sense of urgency and self-harming behavior under emotional distress. This is a part of impulsivity that is not necessarily seen in every manifestation of impulsivity, but when it is in the context of borderline personality disorder, it is a common manifestation. And then slide 24 shows the definition of risk-taking: engagement in dangerous, risky, potentially self-damaging activities unnecessarily and without regard to consequences. Lack of concern for one's limitations, denial of reality of personal danger, reckless pursuit of goals. Again, I think you can see that some of the aspects that were criteria of borderline personality disorder have been carried over. We tried as much as we could while making a fairly radical change in the format for personality disorder to carry over the components of the disorders and to make them be as consistent as possible so they would be recognizable from the one DSM-4 to DSM-5. Slide 25 shows the definition of hostility: persistent or frequent angry feelings, anger or irritability in response to minor slights and insults, mean, nasty, or vengeful behavior. Remember, of these seven traits that I've just showed you, a person must have at least four of them and have them relatively persistently, relatively intensely, relatively stably over time to get the diagnosis of borderline personality disorder. So slide 26 relists the six personality disorders, specific personality disorders that are in the alternative model. And I mentioned we attempted to carry over as much of the DSM-4 as was consistent with good science. So a natural question to ask is, how similar are these six specific types in DSM-5 to their DSM-4 counterparts? And the next slide, slide 27, shows correlations with dimensional ratings of the DSM-4 PDs in two different studies. The first column shows the correlations with a study conducted by Les Mori et al. Les was also a member of the Personality and Personality Disorders Work Group, and he surveyed anonymously 334 clinicians who identified a patient that they knew well. They had to have seen them for at least 10 sessions, and they rated their patient on absolutely every criterion in DSM-4 and DSM-5. And these correlations here, particularly the top four, are quite strong. So correlations of 74, 75 up to 81, and I've highlighted borderline here since it was the strongest relationship of all crossing from DSM-4 to 5. A correlation of 0.75 or higher is a fairly strong correlation, indicating that there is not a huge difference between the two sets of ratings. The ratings for obsessive compulsive and schizotypal were somewhat lower, suggesting that the way that those two disorders are conceptualized in DSM-4 and DSM-5 are somewhat different. They're still overlapping quite a bit, but they're somewhat different. And the second column of numbers is from my own research. They said the first column is clinician ratings. The second column uses all self-report measures. And these numbers are somewhat lower. So I'm going to explore that a little bit more with you as we move on. But again, I thought it was interesting that the rank orders were quite similar in that the borderline had the highest and antisocial was the next highest. It was a little bit different after that, which in the self-reports, the schizotypal diagnosis was more similar. But again, the obsessive compulsive came in the lowest. So I'll be telling you a little bit more about this study as we go along. The next.
Leanna, there's a question.
Sure.
Just a surprise that the obsessive compulsive, which would seem very distinctive, had moderate relationships and low relationships on the self-report.
Well, I think it's important to recognize that this was two particular self-report instruments, one for the DSM-4 and one for the DSM-5. So the low correlation may have something to do with those particular two questionnaires. And we would need to gather more data using other questionnaires for both DSM-4 and DSM-5 to see if that low correlation held up.
Yeah, because the follow-through question was, would this put at risk the cumulative building of research findings on obsessive compulsive personality disorder?
Well, we'll get to that. I actually will have a slide that addresses that question. So if you go to the next slide, the next few slides are about the sample that my data come from. We are still in the midst of collecting. Our goal is 600, so we're just a little bit under halfway. We actually are over halfway now, but when I stopped the data collection to run these analyses, we were just under half. And there's two sub-samples, about a third, a little over a third, are community mental health patients. And the other roughly two-thirds of the sample are what I'm calling a high-risk community sample. They're high-risk because we do a stratified random dialing of the South Bend area, which is where we're located. And those who we reach and who meet the criteria for, you know, fitting into our demographics are given a brief interview called the Iowa Personality Disorder Screen, which has shown very high validity for identifying people who are likely to have a personality disorder. So we screen into the study only those people who are at high risk for having a personality disorder. So some of the data you'll see says community adults, but it's important to remember this isn't simply a normal random community sample. It's a high-risk community sample. The sample's about 60% female. If you go on to the next slide, 29, it's about three-quarters white. And importantly, there's no differences by the two subsamples here, patients and the high-risk community members. Slide 30 shows the mean education levels. About half the sample had some kind of post-high school classes, and the other half either high school or less, or a college degree or higher. And again, no differences by the two different subsamples. Slide 31 shows their occupational levels. About 46%, almost half the sample, were unskilled or clerical jobs. About a quarter each in skilled and managerial and professional positions, and then a few had no occupation because they were retired or not yet had an occupation. Again, no differences by subsample. There were a few sample differences, however. If you look at slide 32, you can see that the high-risk community adult were more likely to be married. The modal participant is married, whereas the modal patient is single. Similar levels of being divorced, widowed, or separated. Slide 33 also shows a subsample difference. The high-risk sample, almost half are employed, whereas the largest group of patients are on disability. Sample 34 shows medication use, and again, here you see a difference that the high-risk community group about a third each on no meds or on meds for some kind of physical problem, whereas 60% of the patients were taking meds for both physical and mental problems. The next slide is the one that's a little bit complicated. This is slide 35. But the first thing I need to note is these numbers are exactly the same numbers that were on that earlier slide that I showed you with the two columns. I've just taken them and arrayed them now in the diagonal of a matrix. So, again, you see that 39 for OC. I also need to comment that I had the key on this graph wrong, and it says it's in terms of percents, but these are actually correlations, just like they were before. If you look at slide 36, suddenly go, woo, look at this, this is really complicated. But I can walk you through it, and it's not as difficult as it looks. The red numbers are correlations of 0.5 or greater. So these correlations are fairly strong. The yellow correlations are between 0.2 and 0.5. These are considered medium-sized correlations. And the green correlations are considered very small or trivial. And the way that you read this is that the individual scores on the PID-5, which was the self-report instrument that was used, the personality inventory for DSM-5, which was developed in connection with the DSM-5 model, you read down there, so it takes someone with schizotypal traits, then you look across that row, it will show you the degree of overlap with the DSM-4 dimensional scores taken from the SNAP, which is an instrument that I developed a number of years ago, stands for the Schedule for Non-Adaptive and Adaptive Personality. So if a person's score, if you look at the relationship on a person's score of schizotypal traits with as measured by the PID-5 with the DSM-4, that's in the 0.66 in that upper left-hand box. If you go on over, the correlation of that same score on schizotypal traits with borderline personality traits was 0.63. So there's not a lot of differentiation between the relationship between schizotypal traits with itself versus schizotypal traits with borderline personality disorder. This reflects the well-known comorbidity that I'm sure you've heard much about. So all of the numbers in red essentially indicate high comorbidity overlap between DSM-5 and DSM-4. The yellow ones indicate moderate overlap or comorbidity, and the green ones where there is very little. So if you look at antisocial traits, go across, it overlaps almost not at all with avoidant and obsessive-compulsive traits. And I know it'll take a little while to adjust all those numbers, but I just wanted you to get a feel for the degree of correspondence between DSM-4 and DSM-5. So go to the next slide, which is 37. We're back to just the diagonal.
Leanna, can I interrupt you for just a second?
Sure.
I have a question here. On the SNAP scores for borderline, five of the relations with the traits are above 0.5.
That's correct.
And borderline. The question is, does this mean that borderline is really not distinctive, but is reflecting something larger across essentially everything except the narcissism?
Yes, what it suggests is that the individuals with high borderline traits show a lot of traits of other personality disorders as well. It is one of the most comorbid personality disorders that there is.
So to get to a distinctive phenotype might not be feasible, and is that a reason for focusing, if that's true, is that a reason for focusing on the traits?
That is the sort of the message that I have been trying to convey through much of my career. That the components of these various disorders are really the key building blocks that we should be focusing on, because we also know the sort of the flip side of the comorbidity is the heterogeneity, that people can have different combinations of traits and still get the same diagnosis. So my focus has always been, let's look at the building blocks themselves, because those are really what the people are experiencing. You don't experience the combination as anything other than the sum of its parts.
I think we have listeners that are on the same wavelength with you.
That's good. So if you look at slide 37, this is just looking at the diagonal, and these are dimensional scores. So these show the degree to which a person has schizotypal traits, antisocial traits, borderline traits, and so on. If we use the diagnostic criteria and use cut points to make an actual diagnosis, the degree of overlap is shown in slide 38. And you can see that the degree of overlap drops considerably when you go to specific diagnoses. What this is telling you is that the overlap, the comorbidity, if you will, of schizotypal PD diagnosed using the DSM-5 criteria overlaps with the DSM-4 criteria only at a kappa, is the statistic that's used, at 0.35. And a kappa that's considered a strong kappa is up about 0.65 or 7. So when you move to a categorical diagnosis, the degree of overlap between DSM-4 and DSM-5 is actually quite moderate. Now, does this mean that the DSM-5 personality disorders are really different from the DSM-4 personality disorders? Yes and no, I think, is the best answer to that. So if you go to slide 39, I'll explain what I mean by that. The yellow numbers there are the ones that I just showed you in the previous slide, but aggregated so that we can make things a little bit simpler. The median of those, the middle number of all of those numbers in the diagonal on the previous slide, is 0.28. So that's the sort of the average degree of overlap between DSM-4 and DSM-5. And I also calculated a number that actually wasn't in that trait in the previous slide, which is the 0.47. And that is the degree to which, if someone had a diagnosis in DSM-4 of any personality disorder at all, the likelihood that they would get a diagnosis in DSM-5. So it's the 4-5 comparison, not for a specific PD, but just any personality disorder at all, and it's 0.47. Again, well off the 0.65 to 7 that we look for a high degree of agreement. And if we look down below the 0.6, that's the median, the average correlation across those numbers that were in the diagonal. So as I said, that's the degree between DSM-4 and DSM-5. Does that mean that they're really different? Well, we have to put that in the context of what does it look like if you use different DSM-4 instruments. There are a number of different instruments that one can use to diagnose personality disorder in DSM-4, and the white numbers show the median of 5 different studies that have compared 2 different measuring instruments for DSM-4. So we're not crossing from DSM-5 to DSM-4 with the white numbers. We are all within DSM-4. And you can see, except for the very first block, the 2-8 versus 3-5, the agreement between DSM-4 and DSM-5 is actually higher than the agreement among different DSM-4 instruments. So the values for DSM-5, they aren't good, but they are nearly as good as DSM with itself, so to speak. So you can look at this as a glass half full, half empty, depending upon the way that you like to approach things. What it says to me is that in both areas, we need to work on our measurement, that we still don't have really strong measurement models for personality disorders. And that's what I hope we're moving to with the new model. On slide 40, I show the prevalence of personality disorder using the personality inventory for DSM-5 that I've been using in the previous slides in this sample of 277. And the yellow are the high-risk community, and the red are the patients. About 33% of the sample has one or more specific PDs, and you can see those broken out here. The most prevalent one is borderline personality disorder, and the very last set of columns shows when you aggregate those. So about 50% of the patient subsample and about 25% of the high-risk community sample had one or more of these six specific personality disorders. The next slide shows comparable data for DSM-4. And what I found interesting about this is slide 41, if you kind of flip back and forth between 40 and 41, one of the things that you'll notice is that in the DSM-5, the patient group dominates over the community group, whereas with the DSM-4, they were more equal. I don't yet know what this means. This is new data, just off the press, so to speak. But the overall percentage is actually very, very similar. Just for some reason, it divides up differently in the two. One possibility for this is that we don't have good norms yet for the DSM-5 data, whereas we do have pretty good norms for the DSM-4 data. Slide 42 is another look at comorbidity, but this time it's entirely within DSM-5. So it's interpreted in the same way. And again, if you look, that BPD column is mostly in red. So again, we're seeing the high comorbidity of BPD within DSM-5. Before, we were looking at DSM-5 with DSM-4. But I think the point is the same. The numbers in the bright yellow in the diagonal are the percent that are pure, which means that the percent of individuals who have that personality disorder diagnosis and no other personality disorder diagnosis. So only 31% of the 54 individuals who were diagnosed with borderline personality disorder, only 31% of them did not have another diagnosis. And 0%, there were only 4 who were diagnosed with antisocial. None of them had antisocial alone. They always had at least one other. And you can see, in fact, 100% of them met criteria for borderline personality disorder. So I'll let you study that at your leisure. I don't mean to overload you too much, but the sort of two key points. One is the percent of individuals that have one and only one personality disorder is small. It's about 25%, and the most comorbid disorder is borderline PD. On slide 43, we have the title of sort of the new diagnosis in town that DSM-5 is introducing, which is called Personality Disorder Trait Specified. And it actually is a seventh disorder that can be diagnosed along with the other six. 44 reminds us that the definition of PD trait specified is essentially the same as for the other diagnoses. You have to have moderate or greater impairment in at least two of the following areas of personality functioning, and you have to have one or more pathological personality traits. For the purpose of this demonstration, this workshop, I'm not sure what label you call it, this talk show, I thought that diagnosing with only one pathological personality traits was too liberal. So I looked at the distribution. I said, how many personality traits do people have in this sample? And that's what slide 45 shows. It's one more little wrinkle. It's actually not the total number that people have. but it's the number of elevated traits, the number of extreme traits that they have, above and beyond any traits that are used for making one of the six specific diagnoses. So let's suppose that someone met criteria for avoidant personality disorder, but they also had elevations on four traits that were not part of the avoidant personality disorder diagnosis. They had separation insecurity. They had submissiveness. They had suspiciousness. They had hostility. None of those are criteria for avoidant PD, but some individual could have elevations on those four traits in addition to elevations on the traits that are needed to diagnose avoidant PD. Now, you could describe that person in the DSM-5 system. You could describe that person as having avoidant PD and four additional traits. But some individuals in this sample, you can see, have as many as 15, 16, 17, 18. In that case, it seems to me that it's somewhat misleading to say that they have avoidant PD. What they have is a very complex set of elevated personality traits, four of which may happen to fit the diagnosis of AVPD, but it's unlikely that that captures the complexity of the personality of someone who has as many as 14, 15, up to 18 additional traits. I decided to use four as the cutoff. Someone had four or more traits that it ought to be considered separate and sort of above and beyond their specific personality disorder. So I sort of used this just as an arbitrary cutoff. It could be that six is a better number to use. We'll have to be doing the research to figure this out. But I used four because that was the typical number for most of the specific personality disorders in the DSM-5. So if you look at the next slide, this would be 46, it shows the prevalence of this personality disorder trait specified in this sample. The first set of bars shows the percentage of individuals who met criteria, who had four or more personality disorder traits, but did not meet the criteria for any of the six specific. So they just had some conglomeration of traits, none of which coalesced into a specific personality disorder. Interestingly, it was about 35% of the high-risk community and a little less than 20% of the patients. The middle set of bars shows the number of people who had one or more specific personality disorder diagnoses, a la DSM-5, and in addition had at least four traits that were not used as part of those diagnoses. And here, the numbers are flipped. The patients are far and away more likely to have additional traits, over 40% of them, than the community group, which is about 20%. When you add those two sets of bars together, the first set with the second set, they add to the third set there. So when you put them together, the percentage of the sample that had four or more additional traits was between 50 and around 60. The next slide shows a very comparable data, but using the DSM-PD-NOS, not otherwise specified. And here again, we see that the overall numbers are very similar, but the differences between the community and the patient disappear. But if you look at that last column, last set of columns, they're almost identical to the ones in the previous slide. So there's a very high degree of convergence between DSM-4 and DSM-5 in terms of the amount of sort of extra trait stuff that's going on that is not getting captured by traditional diagnoses. Slide 38 takes that earlier slide, the first seven columns are from that earlier slide, and adds to it personality disorder traits specified from the slides that I just showed you. Now, what's interesting to me is that this personality disorder trait specified is actually more common than any single specific disorder, and it's even more common than the aggregate of all of the six specific disorders. And this is true for DSM-5. It's also true for DSM-4 if you look at slide 49. So it's the same picture that PDNOS is the most common diagnosis using DSM-4 criteria, more common than any of the specific PDs added together. If you go to slide 50 and you add the prevalence of PD trait specified to the prevalence of any specific PD, you get what that last column is. Now, again, what's interesting to me is there's very little difference between the last two sets of columns. So if you look at the percent of the sample that has any diagnosis of personality disorder trait specified, and then you add in anybody else that has a personality disorder, it increments the prevalence by about 5%, and it's consistent across the high-risk community and the patients. I actually went in and counted. That was small enough. There are 13 individuals in this sample of 277 who have a specific PD but do not have PD trait specified in addition. And again, there's no change really in the situation for DSM-4, as you can see in slide 51. So in slide 52, we go back to the comorbidities that I showed you earlier, but now I've added in PDTS, PD trait specified. And what you can see here, if you look down the next to the last column, is that the percent of those who get specific diagnoses who also get a PD trait specified ranges from 88 to 100%. So the vast majority of those who get a specific PD are also getting, also have enough other traits to be diagnosed with PD trait specified. The next slide, 53, we're going to get into sort of the levels of traits, and eventually I'm going to show you a particular individual's set of traits. So slide 53 shows the elevation on a 0 to 3 scale. This is using the personality inventory for DSM-5, of the 25 facets of traits. Their names are across the bottom. They're abbreviated in many cases, but emotional ability, anxiousness, separation, insecurity, and so on. Now, the green line represents the midpoint of this 0 to 3 scale. I chose this completely arbitrarily. It was closer, you know, it meant anything higher than that was closer to 2, which is the cutoff, than it was to 1, which is below the cutoff. It may be that this is too low a level. It may vary from trait to trait. I just did this arbitrarily as a demonstration. Now, as you would expect, this yellow line shows the 107 people in the sample who do not have a personality disorder, and their average trait profile is entirely below that green line. So that is what you would expect. Now, slide 54 shows the trait profile for the 78 people who did not meet criteria for any specific personality disorder, but did have 4 or more pathological traits. So their trait profile, again, not surprisingly, is somewhat more elevated. The third slide in this series, slide 55, shows the 13 individuals who have a specific PD and a specific PD only. And again, it's a little bit more elevated in many cases. You might ask, well, why aren't there more of these traits peaking above that 1.5 level. These people all have a diagnosis of personality disorder. And the answer is that these are averages over very different types of personalities. So some people, looks like most of them, many of them, are high on anxiousness, but this mixes in those four with antisocial PD, who are going to be low in some traits that someone with borderline PD is high in, and so on and so forth. So averages don't always tell you a very good story about individuals. And then finally, the last slide in this set shows all of those who had two or more diagnoses. And it's not that much higher, but a little bit higher than the other elevations. So this gives us some confidence, at least, that there's a correspondence between the level of traits and whether or not a person has a personality disorder, whether they have two or more personality disorders. Slide 57 picks out two particular personality disorders just to contrast. Avoidant PD is in yellow, and obsessive-compulsive PD is in red. There are 48 of the avoidant and 20 of the OC. Now, one of the things that may surprise you is how similar these profiles are on many of the traits. If you look at most of those traits in the first group, which is the negative affectivity group, they're very, very similar. And the next slide, 58, shows you the three traits on which they differ the most, and these are statistically significant differences. So they differ on rigid perfectionism. As you might expect, those with OCPD are higher on rigid perfectionism than those with avoidant PD. They differ on intimacy avoidance. Again, the obsessive compulsives are more avoidant of intimacy than those with avoidant. And the OCPD profile is also higher on restricted affectivity. I don't have time, of course, to contrast all, whatever, how many combinations it would be of the six. So I want to cut over now and show you the SNAP profile of an individual. The SNAP is this instrument that I mentioned that I had developed, and I'm going to give you, with slide 59, a quick introduction to how the profile here works. The SNAP has been normed on a representative community sample. So 50, and it uses T-scores like the MMPI does. 50 is the population mean, and one standard deviation above the mean is the green line at 65, or one standard deviation below the mean is the green line at 35. So any trait either above or below the green line is considered elevated for diagnostic purposes. The next slide points out that the far left group of scales are validity scales. The SNAP has six validity scales. I'm not going to talk about them today, but just to say that obviously you would want those validity scales to all be between the green lines or mostly between the green lines. Otherwise, you would begin to suspect that the profile might not be a valid one. The next set of scales, shown on slide 61, are a mix of the negative affectivity scales, such as mistrust, self-harm, that's what the abbreviations are down below, and some of the scales that fall in the antagonism domain in the DSM-5, such as manipulativeness and aggression. The three scales that are really elevated there are actually a scale and its two subscales. The scale is self-harm, and the two subscales are low self-esteem and suicide potential. And they are clearly very elevated in this individual. The next slide, 62, shows the positive temperament scales. These would correspond to extroversion, particularly positive temperament and detachment correspond to depressivity and detachment in the DSM-5. And the two in the middle, exhibitionism and entitlement, again are related to antagonism in the DSM-5. And then the last set, shown on slide 63 are, the first two are disinhibition and impulsivity. These correspond to the disinhibition domain in DSM-5, and the last two, propriety and workaholism, correspond to the compulsivity end of that same domain. So if we go back to, or go on, to the profile shown again in slide 64, this patient has a valid profile. We know that because it only has one scale, which is, I believe, rare virtues, peeking over the 65 line. The person is elevated on negative temperament and mistrust, so you could expect that they would be suspicious. They're low, right in the normal range or even a little bit below, and manipulativeness and aggression. Very high, as I pointed out earlier, in self-harm, low self-esteem, suicide potential. They are low in eccentric perceptions, meaning they don't have those kinds of odd thoughts that are associated with schizotypal PD, and they're right about at the cut point in dependency. Then all of their second group of scales, the positive temperament and detachment, are on the low side, but basically within normal range, although exhibitionism is just a little bit lower than the line. It would suggest that this is probably a kind of retiring person, and together with the low self-esteem, you might expect that they would be self-deprecating. And then the final group shows an elevation on impulsivity and a little bit on propriety and workaholism. So interestingly, there's both some impulsivity and some rigidity there. Slide 65 shows this same person's DSM-5 profile. The first group are the negative affectivity scales. I'm not going to go through all of them, but just orient you to the broad domains. And you recall that there were a number of elevated scales in the negative affectivity domain on their SNAP profile as well. The second group is the detachment domain, and you can see they're elevated on anhedonia, which would correspond to the low positive temperament in the previous slide. The third group is the antagonism, so manipulativeness, deceitfulness, grandiosity are low, just like manipulativeness was low in the SNAP. The one that's elevated is attention-seeking. And then the fourth group is the disinhibition scales, irresponsibility, impulsivity, the ones that are particularly elevated. Again, we notice here both impulsivity and rigid perfectionism are elevated, so there's a consistency from profile to profile. And then finally, there's just a little bit of eccentricity in that last group of psychotic scales. Now, I know these profiles are all new to you, so I'm going to talk you through them more with using the terms. So in slide 66 shows all of the similarities between DSM-4 and DSM-5, with DSM-4 being based on the SNAP scales and DSM-5 being the personality inventory for DSM-5 scales. And there really is striking congruence in this profile. I should say, by the way, I forgot to mention this, that I picked this person at random. I didn't pick this person so as to illustrate any particular point. I had two criteria. One was that they have a valid profile, and the other that they have a number of elevated traits, because I wanted to have, you know, something interesting. I didn't want to accidentally, randomly pick somebody who didn't have any personality pathology at all. So those were the only two criteria. Otherwise, I just picked it at random. So using the SNAP scales, their DSM-4 diagnosis, a personality disorder not otherwise specified with both borderline and dependent criteria. They also met the appendix diagnosis criteria for depressive PD. Using the DSM-5, they met the criteria for borderline PD. They also met the my criteria for PD traits specified. And the traits, then, the specific traits that they have in common are listed. So negative temperament corresponds with emotional ability and anxiousness. Suicidality corresponds with depressivity. Mistrust corresponds with suspiciousness. The impulsivity, I've mentioned before, goes along with the impulsivity and risk-taking. Depressivity in the DSM-4 also matches to anhedonia. So there's an impressive amount of overlap between these two trait instruments. If you go to slide 67, you will see the differences, and there are only three differences, and they all are on the PID5. The PID5 picked up some additional traits that are not reflected in the SNAP. This may be because I don't have the cutoffs right. As I said, I did it arbitrarily. In the next slide, we also interviewed all of these patients and individuals participating in our research, and I didn't have time to analyze it to give you overall data, but I did pull out this one patient's interview so we could look at how they fared on interview. We used the DSM-4-SIDP, and the diagnosis that the interviewer came up with was PDNOS, and you can see the traits listed there. And then we rate all of the DSM-5 criteria as well, using the clinician rating form for DSM-5. And again, the diagnosis came up as PDTS. They did not meet the criteria for any specific diagnosis. They were high on negative affectivity domain overall, and the specific traits that they were high on are shown. And again, we see a lot of similarity. The borderline criteria in DSM-4 map onto emotional ability, to depressivity, to the separation insecurity, to the impulsivity. The avoidant in DSM-4 maps onto anxiousness and submissiveness. The dependency maps also onto separation insecurity. So if we look at slide 69, it shows you the differences. The only two differences were that the DSM-4 picked up a couple of obsessive-compulsive criteria and one histrionic criteria. Getting near to the end there, thank you for bearing with me. The slide 70 compares the person's self-report with their interview, all for DSM-5. Again, both diagnoses were personality disorder trait specified. They were high on emotional ability and depressivity, anxiousness, submissiveness, separation, insecurity on both interviews and impulsivity. So the degree of similarity between their self-report and interview was really quite striking. 71 shows the differences. And again, all of the differences were additional elevations on the PID5, suspiciousness, rigid perfectionism, and so on. One of the things that I want to point out in slide 72 is that if you take that particular combination of traits that the person had, they also met criteria for borderline PD. I've been hiding this from you. I'm fessing up now. I said it was PD trait specified, but it was actually both PD trait specified and borderline PD. And you can see in green the traits that would give the borderline PD diagnosis. But I have a question for you, which is if you go to slide 63, this is the overall clinical picture. These are the traits that the person has elevated, self-report, and interview. And then slide 60. Wait a minute. I thought I had another slide here, but it appears that I don't. I apologize. So you'll just have to flip back and forth between 72 and 73. And the question that I have is, does the addition of the borderline PD diagnosis really help to clarify this clinical picture, or does it introduce a focus on a subset of traits rather than focusing on the entire clinical picture? And I think I'll stop there. The last slide is some of the improvements that I think have been made in DSM-5, but you can read those for yourselves. And I know we're over time. I'm perfectly happy to stay and answer questions if others are interested.
Wow, what an awesome taking us through a complex, involved story with such clarity and leaving us with a stimulating challenge. About everything. One comment I'm trying to organize because I don't want to keep people too late. What's the validity? Doesn't this put the, I guess, Doesn't this, doesn't this put the validity of these diagnostic categories at issue?
It does for me.
Okay, because it seems like that's why, is that big in the controversy about the borderline diagnosis?
Well, I think there's a number of controversies. You know, some of it has to do with the fact that, as I showed earlier, even the different DSM-IV instruments don't agree very well with each other when making diagnoses. So someone asked the question earlier about the accumulation of findings. One of the problems in the literature is that it's really, there's a certain amount of false validity, can I say, in that a set of findings that is based on, let's say, the SCID will be different, would have been different, put it that way, would have been different if the interviewers had used, say, the SID-P or the personality disorder examination instead, because we know that the agreement between those instruments is only in the about 30% range. So it's not clear. Maybe the easiest way to say this is that is one of the reasons that many of the research findings are muddled, is because we still don't have the measurement down.
How do we solve that so we can have a cumulative development of knowledge?
Well, one of the good news is that agreement across different trait instruments is extremely high. Personality theorists and researchers have been working for over six, maybe seven decades now. And our understanding of personality trait measurement is very well developed. So moving personality disorder diagnosis to a trait basis in and of itself is a great leap forward in terms of increasing validity and consistency.
Okay. Hopping from that, NIMH has this major emphasis on RDoC, the research domain of Criterion,
right,
with its biological focus on findings from neuroimaging, genetics, physiology, psychophysiological measures, and so forth. Mm-hmm. How do the traits relate to RDoC, or do they?
They do. And in fact, one of the traits is negative affectivity. One of the RDoC domains is negative affectivity. I had a conversation with Bruce Cuthbert a couple of years ago, and he was kind enough to say that some of the inspiration for RDoC was based on work that David Watson and I had done a number of years ago, showing that the way to differentiate anxiety disorders and depression spectrum disorders was really through their underlying personality traits. So while RDoC is putting a lot of emphasis on the biology, it has to touch base with the phenotypic reality at some point. Just biology by itself, we won't know what it means. So if we can't relate it to things like the traits, then it'll be a system locked in on itself with no translatable meaning to everyday life. I think they are gradually acknowledging that fact. I think it's going to take some time because, you know, biological pictures with lots of colors of brains are very seductive. But if we stay locked in the brain, my own view is we need to get out of it in order to move the field forward. It's really bench to bedside. It's not just bench, bench, bench.
All right. I want to pass on a compliment here that Kristen said it was very clear and helpful in their borderline member, family member, to see their pain, the negative outlook on life reflected in the negative affectivity, the emotional liability, the anxiousness, the separate, you know, the other features that are there. So it really seemed to ring true and kind of elaborate beyond the label. But the other question that came from that same person was, have you looked at positive traits in assessment and use in treatment?
Yes, that's a really good question. And we debated that a lot, actually, in our work group. We simply did not have time to develop a full panoply of positive as well as negative traits. So we decided, since it was a diagnostic manual for mental disorders, we would focus on the pathological end. However, there's ample data, and David Watson and I and a couple of our colleagues have published this just quite recently. There's a special section of the journal Assessment coming out that's entirely focused on personality disorders using the TID-5 and other DSM-5 measures. And one of the things that we show in there is if you include positive measures along with the negative measures, the trait picture is much clearer, because it's like the old story of a fish doesn't know what water is because they're so completely surrounded by it. If you only have the negative affectivity, the negative traits, you can't see traits as clearly as if you have the contrast with the positive traits. So I think that's a very important next step, and that very definitely needs to be taken.
Okay, because there's just some implications for treatment people feel, and particularly in recovery and building on the positive traits.
Right. And in fact, the SNAP has a number of traits that are primarily positive. For example, positive temperament. Low scores on that are far more concerning than high scores. So what you want to see is positive temperament going up over the course of treatment.
Not Do you always. Think positive psychology could be helpful in this?
I think it has its role. I have some concerns about sort of being naively positive, but I certainly think there's something to positivity, and that's clearly a direction that we want to move.
Right. With existing treatments, this is a question, take you back to your days of overseeing the clinical training program at Iowa. Wonder if one looks at the personality traits, are there existing treatment models for borderline? Marshall Linehan's dialectical behavior therapy, mentalization, et cetera, that would really seem to fit well, or do we really probably need new treatment approaches?
Well, I think that we can probably build on the treatment models that we have. And if you look at, say, dialectical behavior therapy, its primary success has been in lowering self-harming behavior. That's the dimension that comes out over and over again as showing the most change over the course of treatment. In mentalization, a lot of what that therapy is doing is focusing on criterion A, on the developing the clearer sense of identity, the boundaries, the empathy, the intimacy. And so I think that kind of treatment is already in place for criterion A. I think we also have some pieces in other types of treatments. For instance, Kim Grotz is focusing her treatments on the treatment of emotional dysregulation. Well, that corresponds to the trait of emotional lability in negative affectivity. There are anger management treatments. That corresponds to the trait of hostility. I've actually been talking to several researchers saying we need to build on what we already have, but add to it to build a new treatment model that's, I'm sort of conceptualizing it as modular. You look at whatever the person's profile of traits is, and we develop a way of dealing with, a way of addressing elevations on each of these different kinds of pathological traits.
Clearly, a toolkit where you pull out the particular tools that you need for the things to be addressed.
Exactly.
Okay, there's many more questions, but I don't want to unduly impose on you. I really appreciate your staying on with us. But there were a group of questions about the DSM work group, and your comments when we discussed this before we began the show I thought were very helpful. Would you mind going through that? Kind of people just wondering what in the world happened with this work group that was all over the place and became the kind of controversial center for DSM.
Yeah. Well, as you can imagine, it's a lot harder to build something that's quite different than it is to tweak something. We decided at our first meeting that we did not want to tweak. There was 100% agreement on that. And there was very good agreement, not only among ourselves, but in the field, that DSM-4 had some major problems as far as the personality disorders and really needed some major reform. The difficulty was that everybody had a different idea of how it should be reformed. So we did, admittedly, go through a kind of zigzaggy course to get to where we finally ended up. And it was really a combination of a hybrid, as it were, of scientific issues where we had data, but also political pressures. Clinicians were very concerned about continuity. People were concerned about third-party payers and whether a dimensional system would be recognized and how it would be recognized and treated by insurance companies. There were some very conservative forces within the APA who were concerned about the continuity again with the DSM-4 and of putting something out there that wasn't fully tested. And we knew from the beginning, and initially we were given a green light from the beginning to do something rather different, and we knew sort of the direction in which we wanted to move, but we really weren't prepared for the backlash. And in fact, even the co-chairs of the DSM, I think, were a bit surprised by the backlash. And I think it was simply, as I said, because everybody had a different idea of what should be the replacement, and we had incomplete data. And that was ultimately the reason that the Board of Trustees decided to put it in the Section 3 rather than in the main body of the manual. In retrospect, it should have been in the appendix in DSM-4, and then we wouldn't be having this discussion today. We've been having it over the past 20 years, and we would really have something usable today.
Just people wonder what Section 3 is.
Section 3 is the first section. Section 1 is all the introductory material. Section 2 is the main body of the manual where all of the standard criteria are. And Section 3 is entitled Emerging Measures and Models. And it has information about different kinds of measures that the APA is developing for severity and cross-cutting measures. And it also contains the alternative DSM-5 PD model.
And there's no longer an Axis 2?
Axis 1 and Axis 2 and 3, 4, 5 are gone.
Right.
So a personality disorder diagnosis is just right along with all of the other diagnoses.
Okay, I've got so many more, but one last. Because you mentioned personality traits showing up with, applying it through RDoC with the other disorders. Mm-hmm. Kind of, can you give a quick sense of where that might be that people could grasp with? Where's personality traits with depression or with schizophrenia?
Well, that's a big question, but there actually is a fair amount of research showing that you can organize mental disorders into a hierarchical structure. And personality traits actually seem to be the foundation of this structure. So, as I mentioned, take anxiety and depression. That's a fairly clear example. They are fairly highly comorbid. And one reason for this is they actually share the trait of negative affectivity. However, they differ on other traits. So depression is also manifested by very low positive emotionality or positive temperament, low extroversion. So individuals who are depressed are socially withdrawn, they have no joy in their lives and so forth. So that is a unique personality dimension, unique to depression, at least vis-a-vis anxiety. And anxiety also has its own specific personality features. So, and they vary dependent upon the particular personality disorder. So obsessive compulsive has different traits from panic and so on. But those personality traits really do seem to sort of provide the, and probably biologically based, foundation for the development of a whole array of psychopathology. You can also see another good example would be eating disorders. There's certain personality traits that are much more likely to be found in an individual with anorexia and a different set that's found in an individual with, say, bulimia.
Huh. Personality's everywhere.
It is everywhere.
Oh, thank you so much. This has just been so spectacular. You have stirred up, given us a enormous harvest of findings and perspective to chew on and digest, humble us in terms of where the disorder is, but also challenge us in our mission to support and encourage research to advance things that, boy, the work to be done.
The work to be done, right.
So thank you so much, and everybody, tune in next week. Mike McCuskey will be back with his NIMH R01 on possibility of adverse side effects from during the early stages of taking borderline patients taking SSRIs for their borderline. So hope to have you with us then. And everybody have a good evening and a great week.
Thank you, Leanna and Jim. Thanks so much for a wonderful call-in.
Thank you.
Bye-bye, all.